Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
Modern Ukraine was entirely created by Russia. That was Vladimir Putin in a televised address that he gave on the 21st of February. And Dominic, the Russian president has really been casting himself as a top analyst of Ukrainian history recently, hasn't he?
He has indeed, Tom. Obviously, we've been looking forward to doing a podcast about the history of Ukraine for a while. We did think about having self-styled historian of Ukraine, Vladimir Putin from Moscow, but he's otherwise engaged, it seems, in invading Ukraine. So we're going to do the whole sweep ourselves without his assistance, would you believe? Aren't we? We're going to. It's an amazingly interesting, convoluted, and complicated story, the history of Ukraine.
It is, absolutely. And on that line that I began with, modern Ukraine was entirely created by Russia. I mean, that is very important to Putin. Obviously, it provides him with his casus belli, his justification for invading Ukraine. But implicit in our intention to look at the history of Ukraine as something distinct is a kind of rejection of that idea, isn't there?
Yes, I don't think. Well, we're going to go through the history for, 1,500 years or so, 1,200 years, I suppose. But I don't think that history does show that Ukraine was created by the Bolsheviks. I don't think it was. There was obviously Ukrainian national sensibility before that, a sense of Ukraine as a distinct place. The name Ukraine means kind of Ukraina, the land on the edge, the kind of borderland. And that's part of Ukraine's problem. But it is not Muscovy. It is not Russia. It is something distinct. And to Vladimir Putin, that is an affront because he thinks it should be part of Russia, that the Ukrainians are little Russians. But as we shall see in the sweep, they have a very entangled, complicated history, rather like Britain and Ireland, actually, or, lots of other countries with smaller neighbours. But they are different phenomena.
And Dominic, do you think that the reason that this story is very, very complicated, that as the listeners will find out, there are a lot of partitions, the borders kind of move this way and that, they vanish completely and so on. Do you think that is essentially what enables Putin to make this case? That Ukraine often, hasn't existed as a national entity for long sweeps of time?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth in that, Tom. I think it's part of it. It's part of a part of Europe that includes, let's say, Poland or Belarus, where borders have changed a lot, where empires, great empires, have swallowed up nations, and then they've disgorged them again at the end. And I think that makes the story much more complicated. And almost every detail of what we'll be talking about is actually contested. So even the names, you and I both call Kiev. Well, we think of it as Kiev.
Kiev, don't we?
Exactly, because yes. We're children of the sort of 70s.
Of that age.
And even the names of the places, the names of the people are contested. So for those of you who are listening, kind of poised to complain, we'll probably get them all wrong one way or another, because that's the nature of the beast, actually. I mean, even the very origins of Ukraine have been argued about by historians.
Dominic, just before we go back and we start looking at the history of it, two further questions. The first is, do you think our sense of Ukraine as a distinct national cultural entity, that's been blotted out by the fact that its history in the 20th century was so horrendous, so that we tend to think of its sufferings rather than perhaps of its cultural achievements?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, Tom. We think of Ukraine as part of what the historian Timothy Snyder calls the bloodlands. So kind of Belarus, Ukraine, Lithuania, Poland, places that were fought over by Hitler and Stalin, basically, as just a sort of colossal blood-soaked battleground. And there is much more to the history than that.
Yeah.
But it has to be said, there's an awful lot of terrible suffering in Ukrainian history. I mean, there's a period in the 17th century that's just called the ruin.
Yes.
And when you've got a bit of your history that's called that, it's not good.
And one last question before we plunge into the vast sweep of Ukrainian history. Previously, we did a kind of emergency episode on the history of Afghanistan when the American evacuation happened. So this is the second time that we're responding to great geopolitical events with a kind of emergency episode of this podcast. How large a crisis do you think this is as a historian of modern Britain, modern America, modern Europe, and presumably a greater moment of geopolitical crisis than the evacuation of Afghanistan by NATO?
Yeah, I think absolutely bigger than the evacuation of Afghanistan was a humiliation for the Western powers and for the Western kind of model, but it wasn't an existential threat. I think it's no exaggeration to say it's the greatest crisis really that probably the world has faced since the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962. Yes. I mean, the comparison that a lot of people make is with the 1930s. It's maybe not massively, it's obviously not quite on that scale, but you know, a war in Europe that could see tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people killed, could see a huge capital city in Kiev be surrounded, potentially bombed. I mean, that's a pretty terrifying prospect. And, you know, you can see it in the sort of the stock market and oil prices that will have, even if, you know, Britain and the Western powers don't become militarily directly sucked in, it will have a huge impact, I would say, on the lives of ordinary people.
Right. So the specific measure that Putin announced in his televised speech on Monday was that he was recognizing the independence and sovereignty of the Donetsk People's Republic and the Luhansk People's Republic. And these are regions in the east of Ukraine, very heavily industrialized, with a lot of Russian speakers. Previously, he had annexed the Crimea, which had been part of Ukraine, but previously hadn't. I mean, and essentially the point of this is that the borders are constantly slipping in this area. And you could argue that that's because it has a kind of fundamentally featureless quality, the landscape, that it's very difficult to draw borders on it. And do you know, Dominic, the first historian to point this out, how difficult and challenging it was to kind of pin down features to work out where you were if you were roaming around this land?
Well, since it's you, Tom, I'm going to guess it's Greek. Is it Greek? Is it the father of history?
It is. It's Herodotus. So this is my big contribution is that the land that we now call Ukraine first appears in the very first work of history ever written, which is Herodotus's Histories. And he describes the Persian king Darius trying to conquer the Scythians, the people who inhabit that region. And basically the Scythians just run away. And poor old Darius goes kind of herring around all over the place, and he just can't find anything to conquer. And then he withdraws and he abandons Ukraine to the kind of the various nomadic people who had lived there. And essentially, that is its history for another, certainly another thousand years and more. It's various nomadic peoples occupying it, kind of loose, vague empires. So, Dominic, we actually did quite recently, about a month ago, an episode on the Vikings in the East, about how Scandinavians came down the Dnieper and established a great capital at Kiev. But you remember that we had the Frochers Pechenegs, who were
Pechenegs were very fierce. Were cutting off people's heads and turning them into golden drinking vessels.
All that kind of stuff.
That was absolutely par for the course.
Which the Scythians had been doing back in Herodotus's day. So
it's just
obviously
a thing that people say about nomads, isn't it? It's just the sort of standard thing that people say. Yeah, so we did do the Vikings in the East podcast, and that's where the Ukrainian history, and indeed, I mean, this is how complicated it is, and indeed Russian history, often begins. So it begins with, for those people who didn't listen to those Viking episodes, the Vikings, before they came, actually pretty much just before they came west to England and battled, you know, the Anglo-Saxons and Alfred the Great, they went east and they went down the rivers, down the Dnieper and the Volga. And this fellow called Rurik, legend has it, was asked to come into Novgorod by the local Slavs and basically sort it all out and install the firm smack of government. And then some pals of his, or some sort of cronies, Askold and Deer, they went off and founded Kiev. And then one of Rurik's, another sort of crony of his, who was the sort of regent for Rurik's son, Igor, a man called Oleg. He went and captured Kiev, and basically that sort of bit of Viking feuding started this state, which you know a lot about, Tom, which is Kievan Rus, and that's where we get Russia, the word Russia, from.
Yeah, but it's ruled from Kiev.
Yeah.
So Kiev, which I think had actually existed before they arrive.
It's been a kind of Slav town, hadn't it?
Kind of fort on a hill. But it becomes the center of this kind of increasingly, I suppose, dare one say, civilized empire, because it starts to take on the influence of Byzantium, of Constantinople to the south. It has this vast sweep of lands reaching right the way up to Novgorod and beyond. So huge in scale. I think one could safely say that the chief feature of this empire is the incredibly entertaining deaths of its rulers.
Yes. So
there's, according to the sources, which are not all they could be, there's a guy who gets tied up between two fir trees that have been pulled down, and then they cut the fir trees and they dang, and he splits in two. And then there's
another
one.
You made the same noise in the full podcast, Tom.
Yeah,
very good to see you keeping the same noise.
And then there's another guy who kicks the skull of his horse and a snake comes out and bites
him.
That's
right. Yeah.
But they're also very proficient. So there's Saint Olga, who, you know, becomes a saint.
But you're a big fan of Saint Olga, as
big,
I remember.
Big fan of hers. And she firebombs refractory local towns by unleashing burning sparrows on them. And then, of course, there is Vladimir, who is the Ukrainian prince who converts to Christianity.
When you say Ukrainian, he's Rus. Okay, they're called the Rus, aren't they? Because for those people who didn't listen to the last podcast, so they're called the Rus because the root means kind of rowers, doesn't it? Oarsmen.
Yeah. Going down the rivers,
yeah,
and the lakes.
So that's what they're so what they're sort of creating is it's a sort of it's not quite maritime, isn't quite the right word, but it's a riverine empire of trading stations, and the focus of it, which makes it no longer Viking in the long run, is Constantinople. That's the place you go to sell all your stuff, and that's the sort of great economic and cultural magnet. And you mentioned Vladimir when he converts to orthodoxy. He has a great auction, doesn't he? Not, is auction the right word? He basically sends people out to go check out the Muslims and the Jews and all these different religions, and he chooses orthodoxy. And that is the defining moment in creating East Slavic kind of culture, because orthodoxy becomes the big thing.
Dominic, you mentioned Slavic. I mean, that's also the other great thing, isn't it? That if these are, you know, these Viking chieftains gradually become ever more Slavic. And the parallel that we mentioned in the fuller length episode we did was the Dukes of Normandy becoming ever more French. So it's that kind of process that the distinctively Nordic quality of these princes of Kiev gets kind of swallowed up. So you have Vladimir who you know, very classy. He marries the sister of the Byzantine emperor. So that's, you know, no barbarian prince had ever pulled that stunt off before. And then his son, Yaroslav, who starts off as Yaroslav the Lame and then ends up Yaroslav the Wise, which is the measure of how well he does.
I made the same joke that I made last time. He's upwardly mobile. For a lame man, he's upwardly mobile.
Very good. Very good. And he starts laying down law codes, all the kind of stuff that you need as a go-getting 11th century Christian monarch. And then it starts to slightly fall away, doesn't it?
Yeah, so it's a sort of it's definitely a state of a kind by that point. Kievan Rus, it's huge geographically. It's probably not as it's not as sophisticated as the Eastern Roman Empire, as Byzantium. It's not as coherent as, let's say, Anglo-Saxon England is at the same time, or Francia, France. But yeah, it's a big entity. It's a big and important European entity,
and it's marrying into European royalty.
It is.
It
is European. There's absolutely no doubt about that. Kievan Rus is definitely European, in the sense that there is a kind of a Europe. It's part of the same constellation. It's part of the world of Christendom, all that stuff. But you're right. It starts to go into decline in the 11th, 12th, 13th centuries. Part of this actually is, you know, we mentioned about Constantinople being the big magnet. It's partly because Constantinople itself is having a tough time. in these years, particularly after the Crusades. So the Crusades, which are responsible for so much kind of misery in the world, when they sack Constantinople in 1204, that's very bad news for Kiev and Rus, because Constantinople is where they sell all their stuff. That's their kind of, that's their destination. And that's sort of, you know, that's it puts more pressure on. And also the Kievan rulers, they have a very strange system where when one dies, it's not necessarily the oldest son that succeeds. It's just the next eldest person in the whole family. So that just makes
that's it, disaster, isn't
that
it?
That just makes it endless. Yeah, because if there's like one family person feuds older than you, you know, you just kill them. But as soon as you're the oldest, you have to watch your back. So, yeah. So there's yeah, a terrible
make for a good Christmas.
There's a terrible amount of feuding, and even before the arrival of some very colourful characters from the east, who we'll come to in a second. Even before that, there is a sense that Kiev is losing a bit of momentum to two other rivals that are both in what is now Russia. So one is Novgorod, which is of long standing, and the other is a principality called Vladimir Suzdal, which is nearer to Moscow, which is sort of central Russia. So it's sort of losing a bit of momentum. And then we have these characters who all the listeners will have heard of, called the Mongols.
Yeah. And generally when the Mongols turn up,
that's bad news.
It's not good news, is it? And they turn up outside Kiev in 1240.
They do. So the Mongols, we have I know we'll have some new listeners because it's a newsworthy subject. So if you enjoy what you're listening to, we have a podcast coming up in a few weeks just about Genghis Khan and the Mongols, which should be very good fun, with a friend of the show, Ali Ansari. The Mongols, this is a bit of a spoiler. I don't know whether Ali's going to try and present a revisionist take on the Mongols. The Mongols, I think are pretty poorly behaved. So they turn up outside Kiev in 1240 and they sack Kiev. I mean, they're basically as they do to every city that defies them. They sack it. They absolutely tear everything down. They kill, I think, 50,000 people and destroy out of 40 big buildings. They tear down 34 of them. They basically utterly level Kiev. And after that, the power of Kievan Rus is utterly, utterly broken. The state basically is destroyed. And that, the coming of the Mongols, I think, is such an important moment in this story, because Kievan Rus, which occupied what was now Ukraine, is broken. And the big rising power is a grand duchy that basically is a client of the Mongols, is a vassal of the Mongols and a kind of intermediary of the Slavs. And that is a place called Muscovy, Moscow. And that's going to be the genesis of Russia. So you get a slight, it's also Orthodox. It's got the same Slavic culture, but it's a different kind of pole to Kiev.
But also, I mean, in the 14th century, if we're looking at Kiev and Rus, what has been, you know, what's going to become Ukraine, it's basically divided three ways, right?
So, yeah, so it's really messy.
The Mongols, the brilliantly named Golden Horde.
The Golden Horde. Imagine
my favourite horde.
If you were going to have a horde, you'd call it the Golden Horde, wouldn't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd go for the Golden Horde every time.
Yeah.
And then Poland, which of course is Catholic.
Yeah.
And then there's another duchy, which is the Grand Duchy of Lithuania.
Yeah, such an interesting subject. So long-standing listeners will know that we promised about 18 months ago that we would do a podcast about the history of Poland and Lithuania, the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, because it's such a strange state. But basically, yes, you got there's the Golden Horde, and that sort of evolves or devolves in or sort of degenerates into basically a Crimean Khanate. So Crimea is this peninsula that juts out into the Black Sea, and there's a Khanate based on Crimea.
And that's where the Black Death originally comes to Western Europe, because there's a siege there and they supposedly fire bodies and all that kind of stuff.
That's right. Exactly right. And then you've got a bit that's run by the Poles, and then you've got a bit that is taken over by Lithuania. And Lithuania is a very strange place because it's a massive, massive realm, but it's quite sort of, it's not immensely sophisticated by European
standards. They're still pagan at
this
stage.
And it's pagan. Yes. So interesting. It's the last pagan redoubt in Europe. But then in 1385, Lithuania and Poland basically have a dynastic alliance. They're still separate. It's a bit like Scotland and England under James, friend of the show, James I, with his big tongue. So Poland and Lithuania have the same king, who is Vladislav Jagiełło. And he,
well pronounced.
Thank you. My Polish is top notch. So they become, they have the same ruling kind of elite, or the same king rather. And then in 1569, they finally become united in one Commonwealth, the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. And actually, if you look at a map of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, almost all of present-day Ukraine is part of that. It's not
it
part
reaches of, all the way to the Black Sea, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean,
it's kind of amazing.
All the way to the Black Sea. It's not part of, so it's, again, it is absolutely not part of Muscovy at this point. It does have a separate, distinct history. Yes, it's Slavic. Yes, it is Orthodox. But it is ruled. And actually, what ends up happening is that what becomes Belarus belongs to the Grand Duchy of Lithuania, that part of the Commonwealth. And what becomes Ukraine belongs to the Kingdom of Poland. So that's how, partly how Belarus and Ukraine have separate identities. And then basically the story is kind of, you know, they've got Polish overlords.
And the Poles are Catholic.
They are, exactly.
And so the Ukrainians are Orthodox.
Yeah.
So what kind of tensions are building up there?
Big tensions, Tom. You love a religious tension.
I do.
So what you have is, we're going forward now, the Commonwealth was created in 1569, so in the 16th, 17th centuries. And you have to imagine it's very, very rural. It's kind of flat rural territory. These huge landed estates with Polish elites, Catholic elites. The Polish later call it the Kresy, which is the edge lands. And that gives you a sort of sense of how people have often thought of Ukraine. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Herodotus and the borders, this idea of being a constant fracture zone, a kind of border zone. I mean, it doesn't mean it doesn't have a distinct identity of its own, but it means there's always people fighting over it. Anyway, the Poles, as you say, are Catholic. What come to be called the Ukrainians, so the word that people use before Ukraine is Ruthenians, which is obviously comes from Kievan Rus.
And they continue to use that word, don't they? Right. I mean, in Austria and Hungary and all that kind of, the word Ruthenian continues to mean Ukrainian up until what, the 19th century, is it?
Yeah,
I mean,
early 20th century, Tom. Yeah. Early 20th century, definitely, absolutely. And there are still people who are called Rusins in kind of the Carpathian Mountains. To this day, people who call themselves Rusins. So from Rus. Anyway, so they are Orthodox, as you say, but they're ruled by kind of Catholic overlords. And what you have, which is really interesting, is that in 1596, basically, they do a deal with the Vatican, because obviously religious identity is so important. And the deal is that they will create their own sort of church within Catholicism that is both Orthodox and
Catholic.
Who's
doing this? The Ukrainian nobles?
The sort of, yes, exactly, the religious elites in what is now Ukraine.
Right.
So it's called the Uniate Church. So basically, it's a Catholic church. It's under the jurisdiction of the Pope, but they get to keep their Eastern Rite. They get to keep their Slavonic liturgy, and they get to have married clergy even, which Catholics aren't normally allowed. So in other words, it looks like an Orthodox church, but it's under sort of Catholic suzerainty. And that becomes a huge dividing line for the next kind of 300 years or so, because the Russians, who are obviously Orthodox, don't approve of, when they end up ruling Ukraine, they don't approve of the Uniate Church at all. They're completely against it because they see it as anti-Russian.
Yes. And also at the same time, isn't it about kind of 1580 that a kind of great cultural center is founded, and it has a printing press, and I think the first Bible in Slavonic is published there. So it's this, you're starting to get the sense of this distinctive, dare we call it Ukrainian yet? I mean, that's kind of anachronistic, but a distinctive religious culture, a distinctive intellectual culture is starting to emerge.
Yeah.
You know, and it's the end of the 16th century, which is a time where this is happening across Europe. So again, this is part of it's not specific to this eastern half of Europe. It's happening in London, it's happening in France, it's happening all over the place.
Right.
Amsterdam.
The story is not, as you say, absolutely, it's not a unique story. They are a definite, there are people with their own kind of folkloric traditions, their own religious traditions and so on. And as you say, through printing, and that will become a much bigger thing, obviously through literacy in the 19th century, they're getting a sort of sense of themselves, of their own distinctiveness. But there is one other element that I think is pretty unique.
Yes, so I was going to ask you about that. So
you don't know what it is, Tom?
Or do you? I do. Would it be the Kazakhs?
It is.
The adventurers, the free men, that we know as the Cossacks.
It is, exactly. Very good. So yeah, the word Kazakh is Turkish. And as you say, it means kind of outlaw, kind of freebooter.
Lad.
Yeah, sort of soldier of fortune. And what basically happens is that in this area of sort of what is now southeastern Ukraine, there are these places that the Poles call the wild fields. This is big sort of open steppes. Yeah. And over time, runaway serfs, exiled nobles, bandits, outlaws, they end up kind of taking refuge in these great sort of open grasslands where their enemies or the sort of Muscovite or the Polish authorities can't catch up with them. I mean, it's a bit like a kind of Wild West in American West scenario.
Except that they're gathering honey.
Yeah.
It's a lovely detail.
They are. They're beekeepers. They're frustrated beekeepers. So they end up in this, they go to the Lower Dnieper. There's a phrase which means beyond the rapids. So beyond the rapids of the Lower Dnieper. And it's Zaporozhye. And the place ends up being called Zaporozhye. And they become known as the sort of the Zaporozhian host. I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrongly, by the way, so don't bother. My Ukrainian is not as bad as my Russian,
just say the Cossacks?
Yeah. Well, we should do, but I think the fact that they're a host, we've had a horde, I think you've got to have a host as well.
Yeah.
So they are, they're not Uniat, they are Orthodox. And they are they're kind of answerable only to themselves, and they're very kind of volatile and fierce and stuff. And they don't like the Poles. They don't like being bossed around by the Poles.
Are they a proud and freedom loving people?
They are. They're a bit like those. Who are those fellows in Game of Thrones?
The Dothraki.
The Dothraki. There's a bit of a kind of Dothraki. I mean, the Dothraki are also kind of Native American.
Well, in which case, they're a throwback to the Scythians and the tradition of nomadic people.
I think they absolutely are. And almost self-consciously, actually, Tom, that they have this sort of, there's a sort of libertarian element, anarchic element to them. And a very important figure, actually a massively important figure in this history, I shouldn't undersell him, is a Cossack leader called Bogdan Khmelnytsky. I'm sure I've pronounced that very poorly. I noticed you're not pronouncing any of these names.
Well, I knew that his name was coming, so I've been practicing it all morning.
And you never got to say it.
No. So this guy, go on, tell us about him.
Bogdan Khmelnytsky. So he leads a rebellion against the Poles, against the Polish kind of landowners of Cossacks in 1654, which is an incredibly important date. One of the really important dates in this whole story. It's 300 years, by the way, before Khrushchev will give Crimea to Ukraine. And he does that deliberately because it's the anniversary of this moment. So Khmelnytsky reaches a deal with the Russian Tsar at this point, 1654. And the details of that deal have been argued about very ferociously by Russian and Ukrainian historians.
Okay, so what would Putin say about it?
Putin would say Khmelnytsky and the Cossacks agreed that in return for Russian aid against the Poles, they would be basically vassal subjects of the Russian Tsar. And that from this point onwards, the Cossacks living in southern and sort of eastern Ukraine were subject to the overlordship of Moscow.
And what would Ukrainians say?
Ukrainians would say, no, that's not right. The deal was that we would be allied to the Russians and we would maybe acknowledge them in a very vague way as overlords, but we would have our own chief called a hetman, our own leader. We'd have our own arrangements. We would be able to conduct our own foreign relations. And I'm not qualified to tell you which of those versions is accurate. And in a way, Tom, I suppose it doesn't really matter which is truly accurate, if one was. What matters is the meaning that people give them now. Russians see this as proof that Ukraine is kind of subject to Moscow, and Ukrainians say, no, this is a moment of our independence.
So, Dominic, this is happening 1654. At the same time, in Britain and Ireland, this is when the protectorate, Cromwell's...
Oliver Cromwell, yeah.
...is, you know, his troops are essentially brutalizing Ireland. very much kind of annexing it to English control. Cromwell has also brought Scotland under English control. Do you think, is there a kind of similar process there, do you think? A kind of inchoate process of state formation?
Do you know what, Tom? It's not a bad analogy. I mean, obviously, it's not an exact analogy by any means. But I did, when I was reading this story and preparing for this podcast, I did think quite often about the relationship with Britain and Ireland. And, you know, that sort of sense of having very much intertwined histories, but distinct, exactly. That it's the same thing. You know, it would be mad now. It would be mad to deny that Britain and Ireland have an incredibly tangled history, but it would equally be mad to deny that Ireland is different, that it has its own identity and its own kind of flavor, its own historical narrative.
And so would it be an exaggeration to say that the way that Ukrainians feel now about Russian claims that Ukraine is part of Russia would be like the Irish might feel if suddenly someone in Britain said, you know, you're part of the United Kingdom?
I think you're exactly right, Tom. That's exactly what I thought. It's funny that we both thought the same thing because we didn't. This is a bit like when Putin said to his men and the thing on Monday, we absolutely haven't discussed this beforehand. You will now tell me what you think. So this is, I mean, we genuinely haven't discussed
this. We genuinely haven't, no.
Beforehand. And this is exactly what I thought, that it is rather like somebody in 21st century Britain said to somebody from Limerick, you're not actually Irish because that's not a thing. You're all British. I mean, it would be unthinkable, wouldn't it? It would seem demented.
Although, of course, there are people in Ireland who do say they're British. So again, that's a.
But I don't think they would deny. I don't think even they would deny that there is such a thing as being Irish. I think the implication of the more extreme kind of Putinist interpretation is that basically Ukrainians are just a form of Russians.
But it's just that if we think that the complexities of. Russian speakers who perhaps are sympathetic to what Putin's doing in the eastern regions of Ukraine, and this is all, you know, weird stuff that has nothing to do with us. And you just have to look at Northern Ireland to see the historical legacy of different traditions, different rulers, all that kind of stuff.
Just on the language thing, it was really interesting, actually. Volodymyr Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, is a Russian speaker. And actually, lots of Russians, being a Russian speaker does not automatically mean you are pro-Russian. Rather like, actually, in Ireland, being an English speaker doesn't mean you crave unity with the United Kingdom. Anyway, maybe, Tom, we should have a break now, and we should return with...
The Ruin.
The Ruin, exactly.
So don't go away. We will be back with The Ruin.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome back to The Rest is History, to a special edition we are doing on Ukraine, prompted, of course, by current events. Dominic, when we left, we had arrived at the Cossacks.
Yeah.
And the great Cossack chieftain, Khmelnytsky.
Come on, Tom, that was poor.
Khmelnytsky,
yeah,
who has signed a treaty with Muscovy, the rising power of Muscovy. The exact terms of that treaty remain contested to this day. But he's a potent, imposing figure, leading this kind of almost independent Cossack state in the area of what's now Ukraine. But things go very rapidly wrong, and this is the period that Ukrainians know as the Ruin. So what is so ruinous about the Ruin?
Well, there are two moments in Ukrainian history that are just, even by the standards of Ukrainian history, dementedly complicated. The Ruin is one, and the period just at the end of the First World War is the other. So the Ruin, the 17th century is a horrendous period generally, because it's a sort of little ice age, global kind of cooling, famine everywhere, religious conflict everywhere. And what happens in the Ukrainian version of that is the thing called the ruin. The Poles call it the deluge. Basically, everybody fights everybody. So the Cossacks fight each other. The Cossacks fight the peasants. The Poles involved. The Russians are involved. The Crimeans are involved. The Ottomans are involved. There are all these sort of rival armies doing deals with other people and fighting each other. It's utter chaos and kind of bloodshed and famine. And, well, I mean, to cut a very, very long story short, at one point, Ukraine is kind of partitioned along the line of the river Dnieper. So the Poles get the western half, what's called the right bank, and the Russians get the other half, the left
bank. Is that the hilariously named Treaty of Eternal Peace?
I think it is the Treaty of Eternal Peace. It doesn't quite live up to its billing.
The most inaccurately named treaty of all time.
Exactly. What basically happens is in central and eastern Ukraine, you have the Cossack Hetmanate, the sort of Cossack state. As
you wouldn't want to be a Cossack Hetman.
Well.
So that's top Cossack, basically.
The top Cossack is a man called Ivan Mazepa. He's very famous.
Friend of the show.
Very controversial.
Because we did a whole series of the top 10 times that the weather has influenced history, didn't we? And Mazepa featured in that.
I'd forgotten we did.
We did. The Great Northern War.
In the Great Northern War.
Between the Swedes and the Russians.
So at one point, just when you think Ukrainian history couldn't get any more complicated and more
important, the Swedes turn up.
The Swedes get stuck in. Basically, what happens is that Mazepa clearly dreams of an independent Ukrainian state. He wouldn't have called it Ukrainian. They're not using that word, but he dreams of a state on that territory. He's been allied to Peter the Great, the sort of colossal and very, as we discovered in our parties podcast, very poorly behaved, very bad house guest.
Yeah.
Peter the Great.
Don't sublet to a 7 foot tall Tsar.
So he's been allied to Peter the Great. He turns against Peter the Great and basically does a deal with Peter the Great's implacable archenemy, Charles the 12th of Sweden. And they're fighting the Great Northern War for control. Who's going to be the top dog? Who's going to be the superpower of the sort of North?
Which is such a great name for a war, isn't it?
It is. If you're going to have a war. Well, if you're going to have a horde, it's going to be golden. If you're going to have a war, it should be Great Northern, I think.
Yeah. So this is a great, great episode for brilliant names.
It is. And they fight Charles the 12th and Peter the Great and even Mazepa. They have this great showdown at a place called Poltava in 1709, one of the great decisive battles of European history that most people in Britain have never heard of. It is won by the Russians. Mazepa and Charles the 12th of Sweden are comprehensively defeated. And from that point on, really, most of Ukraine just ends up in the Russian imperial orbit. Now, Mazepa, so he's an absolute hate figure for the Russians. And, you know, for centuries, Russian Orthodox churches, they were just going to curse his name on the first Sunday in every Lent. Mazepa, this terrible villain. But in Ukraine now, he is something of a hero. So his face adorns the 10 hryvnia note. He's a sort of national, you know, he's a sort of pioneer of patriotic independence movements and all this sort of thing.
Which is one of the reasons why Byron wrote about him.
Right.
So Byron wrote an entire poem about him.
That I did not know, Tom. Yeah, your knowledge of Byron obviously is second to none. So,
well, it's all set in the aftermath of the Battle of Poltava, and Mazepa tells the story of his life to cheer Charles up.
Oh,
and it's a very good poem. Very good poem. It involves him being tied to a horse and being sent galloping across naked across the steppes.
Well, I don't know. Did that happen in real life? I don't know.
Not sure about that.
Okay.
But you know, for the appeal of him for Byron is that he's a figure of national independence, of, you know, explosive energy, all that kind of stuff that Byron was as well. So we're starting to get into the age now, aren't we, of the kind of the romantic sense that peoples have a national essence.
Exactly. And well, we're getting towards the age of nationalism, I suppose.
Yeah.
But Ukraine at this point does not obviously exist as anything like a nation state. Because
so it's still the Hetmanate, right?
The Hetmanate, exactly. Most of it is absorbed into the Russian Empire. And its Hetmanate nature is basically being whittled away. Its autonomy is whittled away. And Catherine the Great basically abolishes it. At the same time, the other bit of Ukraine that we haven't really talked about, which is Crimea, and the bit just by Crimea, ends up being... That's the Crimean Khanate, and it has been since the collapse of the Golden Horde. Catherine the Great annexes that in 1783. She calls it Novorossiya, New Russia. That, incidentally, is how Vladimir Putin sometimes talks about it. He basically says, you know, it's New Russia, it's part of Russia. This is places like Odessa or Dnipro, kind of big Ukrainian cities. And Catherine the Great settles newcomers there, so Russians and Ukrainians, in place of the kind of Tatars who had lived there before.
But Dominic, there's another region of what will become Ukraine as well, isn't there? Galicia.
Yeah, that's that's still Polish.
So that's still part of Poland, but then towards the end of the 18th century...
Yeah, Poland itself...
Poland vanishes and gets cut up.
It's itself... So we should say, actually, Ukraine is not alone in having this very tangled, convoluted history where bits of it keep disappearing and reappearing, because exactly the same thing is happening with Poland, and indeed with other European countries as well.
They do... I'm sure you must have seen them, kind of get them on YouTube or whatever, where they show national borders in Europe kind of moving at a very fast speed.
Yeah.
So, you know, 20 years every second or something.
Exactly.
And if you look at Eastern Europe, far more than in Western Europe, it's absolutely bewildering.
It is, because Portugal...
Vast empires come from nowhere, spread across, you know, half right. the continent, vanish again, get divided up. And essentially, this is... what Ukraine has suffered.
This is exactly what happened. So Portugal is always Portugal. It's always in the same place.
Well, whereas, until it gets swallowed up by Spain and then it comes back again.
Whereas Poland is kind of moving around all over the place on the map. Sometimes it exists, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it's just in the wrong place completely. Well, Ukraine, yes, the western bit, Galicia, is Polish. And basically what ends up happening is Poland itself is absorbed. Most of modern-day Ukraine ends up being Russian in the Russian Empire, and Galicia belongs to Austria-Hungary. Now, if you look at any map of Ukraine on linguistic, kind of economic, political voting, and all these kinds of things, Galicia, the western bit, always is slightly more different or more extreme than other parts of the country. That's the bit around Lviv. And Lviv itself looks like a kind of Polish or Central European city.
And that is the bit that the Americans... when they withdrew their embassy from Kiev, I think a couple of, you know, a few days ago, last week perhaps, that's the region they went to.
Yeah, exactly.
And
that's where...
persistently, whenever there's trouble with Russia, that's where Ukrainians have tended to go, to that, the Galician end of Ukraine.
Because it's the most sort of Central European rather than Eastern European kind of end of Ukraine. It has been said, you know, I don't know how true this is, apocryphally, Putin is supposed to have said at one point to, I don't know, I can't remember if he said it this to George W. Bush or he said it to one of the leaders of Poland, you know, why don't you just take that bit and I'll take the rest? Because Ukraine isn't really a country. I mean, that's actually not right. Ukraine clearly is a country. As you see from what happens in the 19th century. So in the 19th century, the bit that is Russian...
which is most of it.
Which is most of it. The Russians make a huge attempt to Russify it. I mean, we talked about how Catherine the Great and Novorossiya. So they really try to suppress the Uniate Greek Catholic Church. They want mm-hmm. everyone to be Orthodox. They try to suppress Ukrainian language. What's also happening is that parts of Ukraine, specifically the Donbass, which is the area that is in the news right now, so Donetsk, basically, that becomes very, very industrial. We did a podcast, Tom.
We did.
About Anglo-Ukrainian relations when England played Ukraine in Euro 2020, even though it was held in 2021. And we talked about how Donetsk was founded by a man called Hughes, a Welshman.
And we culturally appropriated him, didn't we?
We did, because we claimed he was English.
Well, we didn't, but...
No, we didn't.
Welsh listeners will never forgive
us for that.
No, they won't.
But right, and that's actually an interesting parallel with Wales. Because what happened in Wales in exactly the same period was that lots of English speakers, English people, flooded into South Wales to work in the, you know, the coal mines and the steelworks. And at the same time, exactly the same time, Russian speakers are flooding into this part of Ukraine to work in the steel, you know, factories and the coal mines and all those kinds of things. So it's the same thing.
And so
thing.
That's why the Donetsk People's Republic and the Luhansk People's Republic that Putin's just recognized, that's why there's such support, because there are so many Russians there.
Well, there are Russians. There are unquestionably some. Whether there are majorities is a very fraught question. But there are definitely. I mean, there are definitely a majority of Russian speakers. But whether a majority of pro-Russian kind of Putinists, that's a different matter.
Of course. But in general, the cities, the towns, the industrializing towns, are more Russified.
They are.
And
agreed.
It's the countryside that is the kind of...
So the peasantry are still kind of Ruthenians, which, you know, the word Ukraine is beginning to be used in the 19th century. And the universities are really key as well, because in the universities and in sort of liberal intellectual circles, you have exactly the same thing in Ukraine that you have in Germany, or what becomes Germany, in Italy, in Poland, in Ireland, frankly, later on, in what becomes the Czech lands. So a sense of rediscovering a kind of folklore, slightly, is it an invention of a national story? It's not, I think invention is too strong.
And also the great creation, writers, right? So yeah. there's Taras Shevchenko.
Yeah,
who is
exactly.
The great mid-19th century writer who is a peasant. So he... No, that's terribly important, isn't it? It's the idea of kind of the authentic peasant consciousness rising up from the soil and
exactly.
giving voice to these deep primordial national instincts that reach back centuries and centuries and centuries.
But they, you know, Tom, you mentioned Ireland before. That's, I mean, anybody who's read W.B. Yeats will be very familiar with this idea that there are this kind of, there are the people of the soil, you know, who've been who've been downtrodden and oppressed, and now they've discovered their kind of national voice.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what Shevchenko represents.
So he writes about romantic stuff about the Cossacks, about how great they were. He writes about how terrible the Tsars are.
And the Tsars.
Lots of folklore, lots of, you know, all that kind of stuff.
He is exactly. And the Russians are very down on him. So the Tsars.
Yes, well, not surprisingly.
Alexander II in 1876, he bans Ukrainian books. He bans Ukrainian recitals in the Ukrainian language. He bans Ukrainian in education. It's very, this is about the point. Maybe it's a tiny bit early, but this is about the point when people are beginning to use the word Ukrainian rather than Ruthenian. And in a way, that's because they want to cast off the idea that they're just little Russians. They're not just other Russians. They've got their own distinct history, and they want to, you know, to celebrate it and stuff.
But this tradition of repression of Ukrainian national consciousness, language, all that kind of stuff, the kind of Putinist approach, as so often, goes back to the Tsars, right? So
it's
a Russian Tsarist approach.
Absolutely,
you stamp down on Ukrainian language, Ukrainian literature, all that kind of stuff, and so what you get in this period, as again later, is that you get Ukrainian writers fleeing to Lviv and to Galicia.
They do, because in Galicia, in the Austrian bit, the Austrians aren't massively keen on this either. I mean, they tried to stamp it down a little bit, but they tried to stamp it down in a very kind of half-hearted kind of way compared with the Russians.
The Russians are all kind of whips in Siberia.
Austrians are all cream.
Forced marches through snow and stuff.
The Austrians are all like fancy uniforms and cream cakes and Mozart. Yeah, they're doing
it. You know what you'd rather have.
Yeah. And now sometimes my editor at Penguin wrote a book about the Habsburg Empire, and he said I was much too indulgent on the Austrians, and that actually, you know, they could be pretty strict themselves. But I still think, like you, Tom, I'd take my chances in a Viennese coffee house before a Russian prison. So anyway, yes, there's definitely Ukrainian sentiment among the intelligentsia, and there's definitely a sense among the peasantry that they are something. They are not just Russians before the First World War.
Right. And so we're now coming, you know, very, very early centuries of the 20th century, and everyone will know that the kind of emergent sense of nationalism among peoples who have been part of empires, you know, going to generate quite a lot of upheaval, most notably in Sarajevo. But before that, you have a kind of group of students, of activists, people like that, the Revolutionary Ukrainian Party, who in 1900 published a pamphlet that for the very first time states as a political goal that there should be one single, indivisible, free, independent Ukraine.
Yeah, and I think that's in
the first year of the 20th century. There it is.
And that's in Kharkiv, Tom, which is actually now right in the firing line of a potential Russian invasion, and is one of those cities that you know, Putinists say ought to be Russian, is really Russian. And the fact that's coming from there is quite telling, I think. So obviously, yes, there was the sentiment before the First World War, and then the First World War completely turbocharges it. Actually, really interestingly, what happens when the Russians, in the first year of the First World War, the Russians make great headway against the Austrians in the first few months. And when they go into Galicia, which has been this kind of motor of Ukrainianism, it's so telling. What do? They shut it all down. They try to suppress it. They try to shut down the Uniate Church. They ban the use of Ruthenian. But obviously then the Germans and the Austrians drive them back. And basically the Russian war machine ends up falling apart in 1917. And if you thought the ruin was complicated, what happens between 1917 and 1922 in Ukraine, I mean, it's not just complicated, it's completely bonkers.
Incomprehensible.
So there's, I'll tell you, I tried to make a list at one point. There's a Ukrainian People's Republic. There's a West Ukrainian People's Republic. There's a Bolshevik Soviet Republic. There's an anarchist group as well. There's a Hetmanate. There's a Directorate. The Germans are there at one point. The Poles are there. The White Russian Army are there. So it's, I mean, you have multiple armies. And to give you a sense of this, all of this, by the way, is missing in Vladimir Putin's recital of history that he did on TV. He basically says, oh, the idea of Ukraine was created by the Bolsheviks. But he misses out the fact that at the end of the First World War, there's this obvious tremendous resilience of the Ukrainian idea because there are all these different people trying to set up a Ukrainian state. So they really do, lots of different people clearly believe in a Ukraine.
But Dominic, wouldn't it be fair to say that also that this an understanding of this is missing from most people in the West? I mean, certainly, basically, from until I looked at this, from my understanding of the period, because
it's so complicated
for us in the West. You have the First World War, and then it stops. But basically, the horror for Ukraine is that the period of horror that is initiated in 1914. I mean, it doesn't stop. For decades and decades and decades, because essentially what had been the First World War mutates into the Russian Civil War.
Yeah.
But Russia at this point includes a large chunk of Ukraine.
Yeah.
So the Bolshevik, basically you've got with the Russian Civil War, you've got the white armies who are Tsarists. You've got the Red Army, so the Bolsheviks, and then you've got a Ukrainian Nationalist Army. And yeah. They're all kind of
Charging
around.
Plural.
Yeah, armies. They're all kind of charging around, attacking each other.
So to give you a sense of this, Tom, Kiev, in 2 years, it changed hands 16 times.
God.
So there's a brilliant novel by Mikhail Bulgakov called The White Guard that captures this. And basically, there are just armies. Every few days, there's a different army entering the city from a different direction and killing loads of people. There are horrific pogroms. There are some historians who argue, the Holocaust in the sort of what Timothy Snyder right. calls the Bloodlands, that kind of gets going even before the Nazis pitch up.
So we haven't mentioned the Jews, and Ukraine is also one of perhaps the great European center of Jewish culture.
It is, exactly. So we mentioned Lviv. Philippe Sands, the human rights lawyer, wrote an absolutely brilliant book called East-West Street, about the extermination of the Jews in Lviv, where he has a kind of his family history goes back to. And it absolutely, for those people who are interested, it really brings that alive.
The Rat Line as well, his brilliant podcast series. The German commander who he's kind of trying to track down was the commander there, I think.
That's right, so, exactly, yes.
But the history of that is much, it goes back to the... So the Jews are kind of settling there through the 16th century, 17th century, 18th century, this incredibly vibrant culture, East European culture. So, in a sense, the kind of the idea that you have of East European culture is at least as much Ukrainian as it is Polish.
Yes, it is.
Right.
Exactly.
I mean, at least as much, maybe more.
Well, because the border between Poland and Ukraine is very messy. There are people on either side of the border. So there's not a distinct, because their histories are rather like Ukraine and Russia, because their histories are so tightly interwoven.
But you do also have this tradition of a kind of occasional pogroms.
You do.
Peasants who, because Jews are settled much more in villages than out in the fields. And then in the 19th century as well, I think there are some. So that's also part of this toxic brew that is starting to bubble up.
Exactly. Yeah. And actually the next few decades are a very grim story. But one interesting point before we get into the grimness, going back to Putin's remark about the Bolsheviks inventing Ukraine, that's clearly not the case, because what happens in 1922 when they form the Soviet Union is basically even the Bolsheviks in Ukraine recognize that the national idea is now so strong that Ukraine cannot be admitted to the Soviet Union as merely part of Russia.
Well, because the Ukrainians had just defeated the Red Army, right? I mean, you know, Ukrainian Nationalist Army had just defeated the Red Army.
Well, because
even though they've now been swallowed up again.
Yeah, because clearly the national idea, as all across Europe in the 1920s, as in Ireland, as in what becomes Czechoslovakia or what becomes Yugoslavia, the national idea is so strong and so powerful, you can't just crush it.
And so that's why it becomes the Soviet Union.
Right. Not the Russian Empire. Because Ukraine is explicitly acknowledged as a constituent kind of nation of the Soviet Union. I mean, maybe they wouldn't use the word nation, but then obviously everything is really horrible. So there's a famine in 1921-22, and then Stalin launches collectivization at the beginning of the 1930s. So basically,
what's really happening is a famine.
Yeah. So what's happening there is Ukraine has been the breadbasket of the Russian Empire, but Stalin wants to sell all that grain abroad to pay for industrialization because he thinks you have to industrialize because Marxist kind of logic demands it,
and he wants to collectivize as well. Right?
Yeah,
so he's essentially. I mean, wherever peasant farmers are collectivized, there is suffering. Because there are more peasant farmers in Ukraine, therefore the scale of suffering in Ukraine is off the scale.
It is. So about, I mean, let's say if about 5 million people died in the Soviet famine of the early 1930s, probably about 4 million of them were Ukrainians. This is the event known as the Holodomor. Yeah, exactly. And it's, it's a terrible, it leaves this awful scar in the Ukrainian national consciousness. And particularly, actually, in the last sort of 30 or 40 years, because it's been able to be talked about more freely. Under the Soviet Union, you weren't really allowed to talk about it. And you certainly weren't allowed to talk about it as a distinctly Ukrainian tragedy, because that was seen as kind of nationalism. But obviously, it's become a massive psychological element in modern Ukrainian identity. Sorry, Tom, I interrupted you. Go on.
Sorry, no, I interrupted you, but I just on that, you said about how people weren't allowed under the Soviet Union to talk about it as being distinctively Ukrainian. And my understanding is that in the very early years of the Soviet Union, actually, Ukrainian self-expression is given license. So Ukrainian does start to be studied in schools, all that kind of thing. And then another way in which Stalinism is terrible for Ukraine is that he slams the brakes on that.
Yeah.
The big process of Russification again. The church in Ukraine, which, you know, is a key kind of vessel for Ukrainian national self-consciousness, that gets very, very brutally repressed. And then under the Great Terror of 37-38, Ukraine suffers disproportionately from that.
Yeah, Stalin is such a strange character because, of course, he's Georgian. Ukraine and Georgia are the two most, they're the two constituent parts of the Soviet Union, apart from Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, which are swallowed up later. They're the two parts of the initial Soviet Union that have the strongest kind of national consciousness. And Stalin comes from one of them. And perhaps because he's Georgian, he's really intolerant, actually, of nationalist sentiment. So when he takes over effectively from Lenin, or from the sort of after the chaos surrounding that's followed Lenin's death, Stalin really crushes, Ukrainian sentiment. And you see that kind of come and go throughout the history of the Soviet Union. There'll be periods when Ukrainianization comes back up, and then the authorities and the Kremlin kind of clamp down on it again later on.
Dominic, do you think that with Stalin in Ukraine in the 30s, he's kind of consciously preparing for a war with what he would call the capitalist powers? But increasingly, you know, that would include Germany. And he knows that, Ukraine is the borderland, that it's going to be in the front line. And so therefore, Ukraine more than anywhere, perhaps, he has to be particularly brutal as he sees it.
Yeah,
prepare,
I think so.
Because it's the kind of, it's the buffer for Russia proper. And, you know, if you've just had a famine that has claimed 4 million people at the beginning of the 30s, with the start of the Second World War, and the declaration of war against the Soviet Union in 1941, fresh horrors, of a comparable scale.
Well, Stalin is paranoid about everybody, but you're right, and he's right to be paranoid about Ukraine in a sense, because, as you say, fresh horrors will come. And that's partly when the Nazis invade in 1941, some Ukrainians welcome it because they nationalists welcome it. So the most famous example is a man called Stepan Bandera, who's a real hate figure for kind of Russian nationalists. They see him as a fascist, as a Nazi, all this stuff. Because at first he's very much pro, you know, the Germans invading. Thinks this is tremendous because this will allow them to be liberated from the kind of Russian yoke. I mean, this is a very familiar pattern in that sort of part of Europe, in the Baltic states as well. Actually, he then turned against the Nazis later on. But
Hitler's terrible. I mean, his treatment of the Ukrainians is monstrous.
Because what you think when you're Ukrainian is, well, we've had the most awful time under Stalin. I mean, it couldn't be worse than under Stalin because so many people have died. The Germans are arriving, hurrah. Because they think of the Germans from the First World War and they think, well, they were kind of our allies and stuff. The Nazis arrive, and yes, as you say, you know, the most horrendous, horrendous.
Because Hitler wants Ukraine as Lebensraum, as a place for Germans to spread.
But he also wants to eliminate the Jews, Tom.
He wants to eliminate the Jews, but his policy for dealing with the Ukrainians is to kind of give them beads. And I think to put up loudspeakers in villages and play music every Saturday so that the Ukrainian peasants will come and dance and that'll keep them happy.
He just thinks they'll be slaves, basically. The Jews will be dead, not as bad as the Poles, though, right?
I mean, the Poles are kind of...
Well, he has a hatred of the Poles. I don't think he has a hatred of the Ukrainians. But he does regard them as inferior, and he thinks if they have a future, it's purely as kind of Slavic helots in this German... You know, new Germany, basically.
And when we talk about the Nazi invasion of Russia, I mean, actually, Russia proper not very much gets occupied, right? But the whole of Ukraine does.
Yeah.
So the whole of Ukraine is under Nazi rule for kind of 3 years.
Yeah, and the course of the future of the Second World War is decided. You know, a lot of these battles happen in Ukraine with the most horrendous slaughter, the Red Army and the Wehrmacht going kind of back and forth. Crushing, I mean, literally crushing villages beneath their tank tracks, civilians being killed. Of course, when you're occupied by one side or the other, your instinct is to collaborate with the occupiers just to get along. But that means if they then lose, the people who beat them will probably kill you or put you in.
Except that lots of Ukrainians then join the Red Army when they come rolling back in.
They do, yes.
So I gather that that more Ukrainians died fighting with the Red Army than British, French, American casualties all put together.
That's a good fact. Kind of amazing. That's an incredible fact.
Amazing fact.
But what happens at the end of the war? I mean, 7 million people have been killed from Ukraine.
And that's including the Jews killed in the Holocaust.
Yeah. 10 million people have been left homeless. And basically, Ukraine has lost about half of its national wealth. I mean, and almost when you think about how we go on in Britain about the... that sounds like I'm being unduly self-flagellating. When we think of the way we talk about what happened to Coventry or London and the Blitz or how Americans talk about Pearl Harbor, and then you think about what happened to Ukraine, I mean, it's in a different league.
I think it's so, numbing. And when you add to that the famine that had happened 10 years previously.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the scale of the human suffering is kind of beyond comprehension.
It is. I was about to say exactly the same. It defies
your brain seizes up.
It defies imagination. It really defies imagination, which is why it's so tragic, the thought of it happening, ever happening again. So anyway, before we sort of get too maudlin, it comes out of World War II, back in the Soviet Union. Stalin dies in 1953. And Nikita Khrushchev takes over. He had been the party boss in Ukraine in the late 1930s. He had orchestrated Stalin's purges there. Khrushchev was, you know, the sort of image of him sometimes that you get is this sort of round, jolly man, kind of exchanging quips with Richard Nixon. Khrushchev had quite a lot of blood on his hands. However, he was perhaps more sympathetic to Ukraine than Stalin was. So we mentioned 1654 and that landmark deal. Tom, do you want to say his name again? Bogdan?
I'll leave it to you.
Bogdan Khmelnytsky. So that he had struck as the Cossack leader with the Tsar. And to mark that moment for the 300th anniversary, Khrushchev gives Ukraine a present. And that present is Crimea. Now, of course, Crimea has always been, you know, its history has always been very closely related with that of the rest of Ukraine, but it has often been slightly separate. Because it was a different Khanate, and then because it was the headquarters of the Black Sea Fleet, and it was, you know, it's not full of, as it were, former Ruthenians. It doesn't have quite the same history. So that creates a bit of a ticking time bomb. the award of Crimea. Although, to be fair, the Russians recognize it and make no fuss about it in the 1990s when Ukraine becomes independent.
So, Dominic, just before we get onto that,
yeah,
the, two things about Ukraine and the Soviet Union after the war. One is they become a member of the United Nations, I think.
They do, yeah. Very strange that so, that happens. But again...
So that, again, undermines Putin's argument that, you know, I mean, the Soviet Union recognized it. So the Ukraine is a member of the United Nations, even as a member of the Soviet Union. The other, of course, the most famous thing that happens in the Soviet period in Ukraine after the war is Chernobyl.
Yeah, 86. Yeah, massively important, I think, in discrediting the Soviet leadership, in creating a sense of, well, it doesn't create a sense of Ukrainian distinctiveness because it's always been there. And actually, there have been moments in between those, in the preceding period, so in particularly in the 60s and early 70s, there'd been a kind of bit of a Ukrainian revival and lots of books and journals and published and sort of people reviving the Ukrainian language and so on. But then Chernobyl happens.
And that is a metaphor and a half, isn't it?
It is. Absolutely it is.
A cloud of radioactivity drifting across Kiev.
Well, actually, most of the cloud, Tom, ends up over Belarus, not over Ukraine. So it's Belarus that is most scarred by Chernobyl, not Ukraine. But as you say, it happens in Ukraine. The authorities in Moscow, in the Kremlin, try to cover it up and deny it for so long. This is Gorbachev. Right, you know, it's not his predecessors. So it absolutely creates a sense of anger and a sense of... You know, it just compounds everything that has been growing for so long. And like the Holodomor, it's a massively important moment in Ukraine's sense of itself as distinct. And you see at the end, I mean, again, Putin in his speech basically says the Ukrainians didn't want independence. It was a terrible mistake that they became separate. This was all because of dreadful mistakes made by the Communist Party, i.e. Gorbachev, and the people around him. And it was all sort of top down. That is, I mean, sorry to say, but that is, well, I'm not sorry to say it. I mean, that just is nonsense. There were demonstrations at the end of the 1980s in Lviv and Kiev by people calling for greater Ukrainian autonomy. There was a new language law in 1989. So this is before the end of the Soviet Union in Ukraine, generated from Kiev, saying they wanted Ukrainian to be the state language. There's a revival of the Uniate Church. There's an absolute sense at the end of the 1980s, as elsewhere in Eastern Europe, that the forces of kind of nationalism and national self-affirmation are gaining ground. And then you get the first calls for independence in 1990. So that's before the coup against Gorbachev. Then the coup against Gorbachev happens. And then from that point, you know, Moscow seems to be in a complete and utter shambles and in chaos. And the new head of the Communist Party in Ukraine is a man called Leonid Kravchuk. And he basically, you know, like so many ex-communist leaders across Eastern Europe, he thinks, well, the way to stay in power, really, is to work with this new force that's emerged, which is national identity and so on. So in December 1991, he has an independence referendum. I mean, you know, the idea that Ukrainian independence is this sort of mistake or this aberration, the independence movement, they win 90% of the vote. Mm. They win in every single oblast of Ukraine, including Crimea.
And Dominic, one of the things that I think, you know, Putin has talked about it a lot, is the idea that there was some agreement that when the Russian leaders agreed to Ukrainian independence, one of the conditions was that they would remain within the Russian sphere of influence and that they wouldn't join NATO and that the Americans would not try and suck it into the Western sphere of influence. Is that true, do you think?
I think it's complicated, actually, Tom. I think there were sort of verbal assurances, I guess. I think given in the late 1980s and early 1990s, I think there were definitely Western statesmen who said to their Russian equivalents at the time, well, obviously we have no intention of, you know, pushing NATO to Russia's borders. I mean, that's not going to happen. And I don't think they said that disingenuously. I think they just didn't envisage it would happen. But then
but it
of course,
was never written into a treaty. Or
it wasn't written into
never
a treaty.
Never a formal agreement.
I mean, what was written into a treaty in 1994 was the so-called Budapest referendum. Now, that's where Ukraine had got some of Russia's, Soviet Union's nuclear weapons. And Ukraine said, we will give up these nuclear weapons as long as our borders are guaranteed. And one of the countries that was, it's a bit like the famous piece of paper, you know, assuring Belgian independence in the 19th century that becomes the sort of casus belli for World War One. One of the countries that signed the guarantee of Ukraine's borders was Russia, Boris Yeltsin's Russia. So you know, that was the, if there was a moment to say, well, actually the borders aren't quite right, we're not happy with them. That was 1991, or between 1991 and 94.
But Yeltsin was drunk, I guess.
Well, Yeltsin was obviously hammered the whole time, and Russia was in an absolute mess. Ukraine, by the way, was also in an absolute mess. I mean, Ukraine actually, unbelievably, did even worse in the 1990s than Russia did. Ukraine, what's it, lost 60% of its GDP. I mean, that's
a lot. That's a recession and a half.
Its inflation rate was in the tens of thousands. I mean, it has suffered this utter economic meltdown, not least because, as we said earlier on, you know, the Donbass and places like that, it's heavy industry, coal, steel, it's dying out. It's doomed.
I did a geography project on it at school.
Of course you did. You know all about Donetsk.
I do. I can still draw a little map of it.
Yeah, but you can't say Bogdan Khmelnytsky.
No, but I can say pig iron.
Okay, well, that's good.
That's what it was all about.
Ukraine's history since independence has obviously been tortured. It's been very difficult. They had the Orange Revolution in 2004. They then had the Euromaidan movement in 2014, which is basically the sort of popular uprising against the pro-Russian president Yanukovych because he wouldn't sign a deal with the EU. And that then triggered Putin's annexation of Crimea and then the fomenting of separatism in Donetsk and Luhansk. And now we are kind of where we are. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, it's not a cheery story, really.
It's not. And I think that's what makes the you sort of feel like, I mean, you don't wish a war and invasion on anybody. I mean, that would be demented. I wouldn't even wish it on the French, Tom. But, but if there's one people in Europe who really do deserve a break. They are the Ukrainians, and I think it's tragic that they are in this they're in this position. Now, we said we wouldn't get maudlin, so we shouldn't.
No. We hope you've enjoyed that. Obviously, we've put this out because of the the situation that we've just arrived at after our sweep through Ukrainian history. We do have, as we've mentioned already, two other podcasts touching on this theme. So there's the two episodes that we did on the Vikings in the East.
We did.
And then there is the episode that we did during the Euros when each time England played a team, we would look at the history of England's relationship with that country. And of course, England played Ukraine, beat them in Rome. So you'll find the top episodes joining English and Ukrainian history as well. And I think we are going to put them up. If you have a look at wherever you get this podcast, Spotify or iTunes or whatever, you will see them listed immediately after this at the top of the list of episodes that we've recorded. So if you haven't already listened to those, we hope you'll enjoy them. Well, Dominic, it's,
Yeah.
Sober stuff.
Very sober stuff. Let's hope,
let's hope it all sorts out.
Yeah, like it will.
Yeah.
Right, we shall be back. If you want to cheer yourself up, you should listen to our episode about the top 10 parties, disastrous parties in human history.
Well, there's quite a lot of death and mayhem in that, but there is, but the fate, the same scale.
It would be hard to listen to the fate of Diedrich Graf von, what's his name?
I can't remember, but it features a
Hoofer Hazler or whatever his name is.
That's all we'll say.
without cracking a smile.
And next week we have an episode on the most calamitous things that you could wear, the things that over the course of the history of fashion have caused the most casualties. And also we have a couple of episodes basically posing the question of when did the Roman Empire fall? And we haven't actually recorded that yet, but I suspect... very much suspect, for reasons that I won't go into now, that the Crimea will feature in that as well. So there will be a further touch of the Crimea in an episode on the Roman Empire next week. So if you've enjoyed this, I hope you will enjoy that as well. And in the meanwhile, goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.